are listening to The Caregivers with Lon Kiefer.
Hey there, how you doing? Yeah, you. I'm talking to you. You might be a caregiver. Hey, I don't know. You might not even know. Welcome home to the Caregivers Podcast, where you are never alone. My name is Lon Kiefer, and I am a caregiver, and I'm also your host, sometimes known as Doc, the Defender of Caregivers. And for those of you that don't know what we're doing here, we're talking to the caregivers of the world, whether they be professional or personal family caregivers, in an effort to make certain no one is ever alone on their caregiver's journey, even if your companion is just a voice on a podcast. So I made a friend today, well, not today, but for this podcast. And this might be the first good thing to come out of the coronavirus pandemic, because I've been chasing this guy for a long time. And, you know, the world slowed down a little bit, and we're, you know, many of us are working like crazy. It's funny, those that are working harder than they've ever worked, and maybe scared and worried. But those that aren't able to work are wishing they could, and home with a lot of time on their hands and maybe a little bit of emotions that are running high and looking for diversions. And so that's what we created for you here with this episode, is a diversion. And the guy on this episode is creating a nightly diversion for his followers. We'll get into that a little bit on the podcast. But this is a guy that is a retired mailman, a sort of a well, he's a professional comedian as well, without even trying initially. And he took care of his mom along with his, I think it was seven other siblings. And I apologize to him and to you. I got some of the facts wrong, because the nature of how we did this podcast, I was sitting in a truck on the side of the road, and we just grabbed some time when we could. And well, I'll let him tell you the rest of the story, and then at the bottom of the episode, at the wrap up, I'll give you some more links and that sort of thing. But let's just go ahead and get started with my time. It was enjoying. As it, I guess that's a word, but it's not the one I was trying to use. It was an enjoyable hour or so that I spent with my friend, comedian, caregiver, and just magnet sort of a personality, Joe Tanner.
Joe Tanner, look, I got you, man. I got you. Here
finally.
You are. Thanks for doing this.
You're persistent, my man. You're persistent.
Hey, I'm a caregiver. What can you say?
I like that.
I'm excited for this, and our listeners don't even necessarily know why. So let's just jump into it. I have a saying in Defender of Caregivers: honor yourself as you care for others. So, Joe, if you could, can you honor yourself and anything that you'd like our listeners to know before we share with others? This is all about telling us about Joe, and then we'll talk about Joe.
Well, just on some, I don't know if you want to call it personal stuff, but I've been married to my wife, Linnell, for coming up on 32 years. We have three kids.
You're never going to make it, Joe. You're never going to make it.
No, I know. I'm a retired mailman out of Minneapolis. Did that for about 25 years, and now I'm continuing with my stand-up comedy. I do that, and now it's, of course, with the things that are going on around us right now, your stand-up comedy just isn't there unless you're going online doing it some fashions like that. And the stand-up comedy at first was to kind of fill a void or a need. You know, you want attention, and I know you do stand-up and you do public speaking and things like that, and when you get a reaction from people, you feed off of that.
Yeah.
And that is very cool to do something like that, and to say something, and you get the people laughing. You get such a response. And what ended up happening with the comedy, somebody said, can you help us out with a benefit? And it was for a fellow that had cancer. And he ended up passing away from it. But we raised him $8,000. I think it was actually $8,300. And I ended up going on to do a lot more benefits. But one thing with the benefits, what I did, I didn't, like Jim had esophageal cancer. I didn't say, okay, $8,300 we're sending in your name. It was here. Here's $8,300. Put it in your sock drawer. Use it to make the car payment. Use it to make a house payment if you need groceries. And that was such a satisfying feeling. And we did things like that. And I ended up, we were trying to add it up one day. We think we've raised about $175,000 for families.
Oh, my word.
So it was quite successful. I think the most we got one family was $28,000. And it, you know, and it wasn't just me, just because I'm doing comedy. We had the silent auctions, and we had the spaghetti dinners, things like that. But there was always the comedy there.
You must be a hell of a comedian.
Well, in my own mind, I am.
I mean, those are incredible numbers. Mm-hmm. I mean, who is helping you put all that together?
Well, I mean, it's. You know, you don't want to take credit for it, but
right.
They'll come and they'll say, "Here's what we don't know what to do. We've never done this." Of course, you never had cancer in your family or a need. And what I will sit down, they'll say, "We can't do anything." Yes, you can. Do you have a job? Well, I have a crappy job. Okay, well, doing what? And it might be whatever they're doing. But everybody out there, if you work in a car wash, okay, ask your boss if he can donate 6 free car washes. We can use that. Oh, yeah, we can do that. I work at Burger King. Okay, get some Burger King coupons. So you, even though the people think they don't know how to do it, they do.
Yeah.
How about a band? Well, my brother plays in a band. Let's get the band to donate, you know, half hour of their time.
Yeah.
So it was things like that, and that's kind of how it got going, really. And like I said, we've done quite a few of them, so.
Okay. So I cut you off with my joke. You said you had 3 kids, right? 32 years marriage, 3 kids.
Yeah.
And
one of each.
And you, one of each kid?
That was the joke. Usually you say we have 2 boys and 1 girl. When you say one of each, it's kind of a thinker one where people think back like, what did he mean by that, one of each?
Yeah. Well, I mean, how I came to know you was on Facebook, and you've got I know you're a humble man. I can already figure that out. But you've got a heck of a following there. And when we spoke briefly, you talked about you're what, the youngest of how many?
Well, I'm not the youngest. We mom and dad had eight of us, 8 kids, one of each.
Oh, wow.
And, all right.
Yeah, one of each.
But there was 8 of us. There was 4 girls, and then I came along, and then there was another girl and then 2 more boys. So I'm the oldest son.
Okay.
Out of 8.
Okay.
And we grew up in Anoka, Minnesota, and that's a suburb of, we're north of Minneapolis. That kind of gives you an idea where we're at.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, how did you become such a big Facebook? You had a, tell us about your mom. Let's jump into how your. I don't mean necessarily about your mom. That's up to you. But this following that you have, I mean, you are helping a lot of people through a difficult time right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, it started off, the name of the page, and it's still active, we lost mom 2 years ago in March, so 2 years and a month or so. I made a Facebook page, it's called You'll Always Be My Mama. And part of that idea was, I know she's going to end up not knowing us, but, you know, we're always going to remember her. She's always going to be mom, no matter what.
Yeah.
And so that was the name of the page, and I made it. Because some of the brothers and sisters are scattered. We're not all, you know, we could see mom every day. So I made the page so, hey, we can post a picture. Here's mom, you know, opening a birthday present, or here's mom petting a cat or whatever. And it started off like that. And next thing you know, and I honestly do not know how it took off like it did. But there's...
Yeah.
Well, and what I would do, I guess I should backtrack a little bit. I would go on there with my phone, camera phone, and I would just make a little video of how mom's doing today, and the other kids could see it. And mom was, she was pretty witty. kind of dry humor, but she'd zing me every chance she got. And people started seeing this, they started sharing it. And some of the videos that I would show mom and myself, it would hit 60,000 views.
Oh, wow.
And then people would send her letters and things from different countries. You know, there was India, there was Nova Scotia, there was Canada, Mexico. It was almost any place. And the UK was huge for Millie. My mom's name was Mildred. But there were many Millie fans across. They'd always say, we're across the pond. And then they would share it. So that's kind of how that came about and some of the following. But to this day, I still get messages, people saying, you know, we didn't have 8 brothers and sisters. It's just me. Or I have a brother or sister that isn't helping. I'm stuck doing it all. So we were very lucky in our family to have that.
Yeah.
But I get messages from these folks all the time saying, what do we do here? And I, part of me wants to say I'm just a retired old mailman. You know,
right.
You know, not old. I'm 60. But I just want to, you know, I don't want to say things like that to them because they're looking for an answer or some reassurance maybe. And so I get to share what we went through.
Right.
And what I went through isn't necessarily what my brothers and sisters went through. We all had our different journey with mom.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, same mom, different journey. And I mean, that's, but that's the thing is I hear you being humble. These folks just want to validate that they're on a different path than you, but they learn from your path. And if nothing else, just being able to hear your path and do both a comparison and a difference type of perspective, it's very valuable. At least that's what the people that I talk to tell me. They take great satisfaction in knowing both the pleasure and the pain that other people go through. Because if it's pleasure, they feel like they have an opportunity to find some of that themselves. And if it's pain, they can at least validate that they're not the only ones going through it. And that, you know, I think that, you know, I've looked at some of the exchanges there and it's a beautiful thing. A lot of those people are still following you even though your mom is no longer with you.
Mm-hmm. One thing I do, and I was trying to do it once a week. I haven't done it for a couple weeks now. It's make just a kind of a hello message, kind of a checking in video where it's just me.
Right.
And I'll just say, I hope you're, you know, like I know your main phrase is thank you for being caregiver, right? Something close to that.
Yeah, I always do the thank you for caring.
Yeah,
I got a bunch of,
Yep, and like my mom's, we would always say see you later, and then she'd say alligator, and I'd say after a while, and she'd say crocodile. So that's how I end it.
Nice.
But I check in with these people and just say, how are you doing? And I hope you're having the best day you can. And some of them are having the crappiest days of their lives because their husband or wife or brother, sister,
right.
Somebody's dying. It's a horrible day. But and you want to say have the best day you can. Well, how can I have a best day when this is happening? I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know the answer. I'm just trying to be a little positive. And so I'll make this video, and it might be just 2-3 minutes long, and just checking in, and I'll answer some of the questions people might have, and just say, here, Ruth from wherever asked this question. This is how I dealt with that. And one of the common questions was, what do I do when mom doesn't do this? I said, you have to kind of pick your battles, which is what we had to do. And we had to remember, you're not going to win too many battles with an 86-year-old with dementia. And,
right.
And I had to, with mom, what I try to tell people is we had to simplify the stories. Like, I couldn't tell mom, hey, mom, guess what? Lon had a podcast, and I was on there. We talked about things for an hour. And I would have to change it to, I talked to my friend today. Because if I
gave
too many details, it was too confusing.
Right. Right.
So,
well, that's great advice. And you know, the other thing that I've heard people suggest is, you know, slow it down and give time to respond. You know, people get anxious when they're trying to get a point across, and it makes it worse. So that's great advice to simplify.
Exactly. One thing, and again, this is a personal one for people to do. Because I took so many pictures and videos of mom, I have hundreds of videos I can go back and look, and it hurts sometimes to watch them. And sometimes it's very I don't know if it's enjoyable is the right word, but it's seeing mom again, and listening to her voice. And I tell the people, take videos or take pictures. You don't have to put them on Facebook like I did. In my deal, my life is more of an open page. If I get a splinter in my finger, I put it on Facebook. Guess what happened today, folks? You know, and a lot of people can't do that. A lot of people don't want to say personal things, medical things. I get that. And with mom, we tried to show positive things. I mean, sometimes if she was having a bad day, I'm not going to put her on our little video. I'm just going to say it's just me.
Right.
Mom wasn't having a good day, and you know, a lot of people understood that. A couple of them didn't. But.
Yeah. Well, the sharing like that is, I mean, people need that perspective. Everybody, you know, they know on a intellectual level and a logical level that you know, they're not the only ones going through it. But then when you get emotional, I talk a lot about caregiver distortions. They're cognitive distortions. They're an actual thing of stinking thinking patterns we all fall into when we're stressed. And, you know, caregivers are chronically stressed. And being able to peer into the lives of others to know and get that validation that you're not alone, you're not the only one to have that frustrating moment or that negative thought, you know, is very valuable. And intellectually, they know they're not alone, but emotionally, they think they're alone. So,
right.
So getting to see you share that is so very valuable, and it's so genuine. You know, I've seen some of your videos. I've tracked this, and I think the reason that you went, I mean, you're just naturally funny. You're naturally interested in things, and it's just very real and very transparent. That's why you've been so, I don't know if you realize, you're incredibly popular. I know it's not something you're doing like you were once were, but the amount of attention that you got is very rare.
Right. Well, I appreciated it too. And you know, when mom passed, we had a couple families from different states showed up at her funeral. And be like, I'm so-and-so.
Yeah.
It's like, what? I was really very humbled that they drove all the way up from Chicago to, maybe they flew, I don't know, but to come to my mom's funeral. It's like, wow. And they said, she's part of our life. You're a part of our life.
Yeah.
And it's like, wow, I hit a nerve somewhere with some people here. But I don't like to talk about that part, but we can, I don't care. But
I drug you into that, and I apologize for it.
It was a good thing. I just don't like.
Yeah.
I feel like sometimes I'm kind of patting myself on the back. Sometimes I don't want to come off like that.
I tell you what, you're too damn humble to be a good comedian. I'm taking back my shock and awe from you. I mean, comedians are, you know, in a lot of ways, they're, you know, it is very addicting and thrilling to be on stage and get that reaction from others. But I know for me, it was always more about not just the way I felt in the moment. It was that I was able to express myself in a way and know enough about my fellow man or human, you know, one of each kind, to elicit that response. It was validation that, you know, I'm on this planet with other people, and that's what I think resonated with these people that found you. And I know that you're humble about that. But here's the shift I want to do. I see a lot of similarities between caregiver personalities and comedians and comedic personalities. And here I have one that is both. Tell me about how the comedy got started.
I have to go way back to 10th grade. I took speech class. I didn't even know what speech class was. I didn't know if it was a drama thing. I didn't know if it was because you had a lisp. It was just speech, so I took it. And I had Jack Nebedrick. He was my teacher. He's still alive. I still see him every once in a while. We did speeches, you know, and he would say, here's our subject this week. You might do a political speech, or you might do a tough speech. I can't – what's the word I'm looking for if it's sad, like a sad moment?
Morose,
like that.
Depressing, you know, dark.
Yeah, or you might do a humorous speech. Well, I found out it's like these people are laughing at me. Are they laughing? Because I don't want to get into the low self-esteem stuff too much, but I had low self-esteem. It's like, are they laughing at me because who I am, or is it because it's funny? And then one day I went to go up. Mr. Nebetterk said, next up is Joe Tanner. He's going to do a speech. Nancy Snyder, who I, ever since kindergarten, knew her, she clapped her hands and she turned to the girl next to her. She goes, oh, good, it's Joe. I love when he does this. And I was like, wow, that was a rush. You know, I was like, well, that's kind of cool. And so that's kind of where it got started. And then didn't really do anything. I wasn't a wild guy, but, you know, I ended up working in the bars for about 10 years as a bouncer and stuff like that. And there's humorous stories I have from that, but that wasn't a place where you're on a stage. But so then my wife and I got married, and the kids were young. And this is, see, Kayla's 30. This is probably 27, 28 years ago. There was a fella in Minneapolis area. He does stand-up and improv. I didn't know there was a difference between improv and stand-up. And he had a 6-week course for improv, and I went there and paid my $30-$40, wasn't much. And then at the end of the 6 weeks, you would invite your friends and family, and they had a little stage where we did a show, and, you know, but it was improv, and it's like, and I had fun with it, but it wasn't what I wanted. I wanted to be the Robin Williams or Louis Anderson. And so he said, well, I offer stand-up. So I took that 6-week course, and that's what I wanted to do. That was fun.
Yeah.
And so I did a couple open stages over here. And then the kids, you know, kids have their needs and you got to help around the house and stuff like that. So it kind of got put on the back burner. And then about 20 years, the KQRS, who is a big radio station up here, big classic rock, they had an ad.
Say that again? Was that kick your ass? Is that what you just said?
No, KQRS. Kick your ass works too.
I swear that's what I thought you said. I'm sorry.
Well, I might have mumbled there a little bit. I got to get a sip of water here in a second. But they had the contest that said, are you funny enough to open for Louis Anderson? And I know who Louis is. You know, I knew of him on TV.
Oh, yeah.
But it's like, wow. And, of course, I'm not funny enough to open for Louis Anderson. Well, what you had to do, you had to take a VCR tape, and you taped yourself doing 3-4 minutes of stuff. You mailed it in to the radio station. And they said about 250 people submitted, you know, samples or video.
Uh-huh.
And I was out in the yard one day. No, I was actually on my mail route. My wife called, and she said, do you know who Scott Hansen is? And I said, the comedian, and he's a Minneapolis guy. And she said, well, he called, and he says that you've been selected to do a comedy show with him and Louis Anderson. She goes, who the hell is this? Or is he making this up? It's like, oh, I didn't tell you. Because I thought she'd be mad because I spent $4 in postage. And, you know, who do I think I am, you know, trying to be working with Louis Anderson? And so it might have been the next day or something. You had to go down there and you had to have 2 or 3 minutes of clean humor. You couldn't use anything off the internet because Louis and Scott will have seen, you know, they've seen every joke out there. So you had to come up with your own stuff. And so I came up with stuff. And we got down there, and they said, go in that room. And I went in there, and it was Louis Anderson all by himself and just me.
Oh, wow.
And it was like, wow, I've seen this guy on TV. You know, now I'm sitting here.
He was really big at one point. I mean, and still is, but, I mean, he was, yeah.
But so either I was sitting there, and he was talking. He just kind of getting to know me a little bit, and he used to tell me about yourself, and I did, and he goes, why do you think you should be down here? And I said, well, I just said, it's kind of an opportunity. You know, I tried out for the Minnesota Twins. I knew I wasn't going to make it, but it was an opportunity. You do something to say, hey, I did that. I got the pro wrestling ring. I didn't do very well, but I got in one match. I know it's a different story, but
Is there video of that?
There is video of it. Yeah, I can put it up there.
I need to see that, Joe.
What they did, they had me come in, and I was going to be introduced as like the comedian of the year, and I was wearing jeans and a sports jacket, and I was going to start saying a couple jokes, and well, then the bad guys come in with a microphone or megaphone and start giving me the business. And he starts poking me in the chest, the manager. He's got these two big goons behind him. And they knew that I shouldn't be in here. You know, So get out of here. And they also we're told, don't hurt Joe, you know, because he's 58, whatever I was. And so he starts poking me in the chest. Well, then at that point, I got to shove him back, and then the big two goons kind of jumped at me. And so I wish now I had done more, because they said you should have done more than you did. But I was told, hey, we can't risk me getting hurt because I'm not really either guys.
Right.
So anyway, so that's what that was. But
I'll
put that up and you can see it.
Yeah, I want to see that. I want to see that. So back to Louie. You told Louie this is a chance. You know, I went out for the baseball team. I did pro wrestling. This is an opportunity. So anyway, you're in there with the room with Louie.
Yeah, and he says, so what else have you done? Have you done anything? No. I said, well, I've been in church dramas, you know, and he's like, oh, boy, kind of like we got a winner here, you know. So I said with the KQRS radio station, or the Kick Your Ass radio station, I said, I send letters in. They have a listener segment, and you win prizes and stuff. He goes, I listen to that. And I said, yeah, I'm the Lowry mailman. And he goes, you're the Lowry mailman? Yeah, he goes, you got funny stuff. He goes, I listen to your letters every week. So it was like, wow, that was cool. So then the rest of the guys come, and Louis's going around the room, and he's asking these guys, you know, where have you been? Oh, I've been at Acme, or I've been at this place, or I've been at this club. I've done this, I've done this. He came to me, and I just said, I haven't really done anything other than some dramas at church. And I thought, what the heck am I doing down here? And what they did, they had, it was like a, almost like an American Idol. They had like 8 or 10 of us, and you would all go up and do your 2-3 minutes, and then at the end he would say, okay, you two move on, you four don't. And so that's kind of what happened. So then the next show comes up, you had to have 2 or 3 more minutes of new stuff, and I kind of took some stuff off the internet, and it was pretty blue. And my wife was driving down there with me, and she says, well, let me hear your 2 minutes. And I told it to her, and she stopped the car. We're at the parking lot of the building. And she goes, that is horrible. She goes, you're terrible. Yeah. She goes, that is not you. You're not a dirty comic. She goes, those stories aren't believable. And so we got into this argument, like, what am I going to do now? The door is right there for me to walk in. I have no material. I don't know what to do. And I said, I don't want to go in. And she said, well, you have your family here. The brothers and sisters are here and some friends. She goes, you're going in. So I walked in, and Louis comes up. He goes, oh, there you are. I said, yeah. He goes, what's the matter? I said, nothing. And he goes, it looks like you just got in a fight with your wife. And I said, how did you know that? But he goes, you all ready? I said, yeah, I'm ready. He goes, okay, I have to talk to you about something. And I said, what is it? And he goes, well, it's your face. I said, what about my face? He goes, you always look like you're pissy and angry. He goes, you got a very grumpy looking face. It's like, oh, good. First, now I have no act. Now Louis tells me I look like a pissy guy. And so I just said, everything's fine. And I'm sitting there in the chair, and somebody went up and did their 2 minutes, and Louis goes up, and he'll do 3-4 minutes. And then he goes, well, here from Brooklyn Park, Minnesota, is Joe Tanner. And as I'm walking up the stage, I'm taking my step onto the stage, I didn't have a clue what I was going to say.
Uh-huh.
And I kind of told a little story about what I just told you, about having a pissy face and no act. All of a sudden, stuff just started rolling out, and it was just like, it's like, I don't know where this is coming from, but I'm going to keep talking. And so, long story short, we end up making it to the last night, and there was 8 of us, I think 8 or 10 left. And the first show, I felt like I'd never, like, this is the best set I ever had. And in the second show, the people were drinking quite a bit, and I was getting heckled.
Right.
And you're new at this. Uh-huh. You don't know what heckling even is till you get heckled. It's like, why are they mean to me? One guy threw a piece of ice and hit me in the head. And
oh,
I just thought, you know, and I got a big head. It's like, well, that was a real tough shot, wasn't it? And so anyway, I came off. Louis goes, well, how do you think you did? And I said, I blew it. I blew it. I couldn't handle the pressure. And it turned out he was heckled. And he had a bad night with this crowd. They were just a crap crowd.
Right.
And so he said, okay, I'm not going to announce who wins, because whoever won got to open for him New Year's Eve at the Northrop Auditorium, which is about 4,500 people. And so you really wanted to do this. And he said, tell you what, I'm going to take these tapes home. He goes, it's too hard to make a decision. He goes, I'll be on the radio on Monday or Tuesday and let the people know who the number one guy is. So I was at work, and everybody knew it at work. They all had their radios going. And then he started to announce, here's who I'm going to bring. And he goes, I decided out of the 10 we had, he goes, I'm not taking one. I'm taking six. Because he said, I think these six guys all have a chance to do something. And he started naming off the first guy. And here's a clip from that guy. And then here's a clip from this guy. And pretty soon it's down to three. And then four guys are named. It's like, crap, I only have two more chances. And then he said the fifth guy, and it wasn't me. And then the sixth guy. And I had gone out to my mail truck. It's like, if I don't get picked, I'm not going to let my coworkers see me cry because I really want this. And he said, Tom, do you know who Joe Tanner is? Or the Lowry mailman. And Tom goes, yes, Joe Tanner. And he goes, yeah, he's number six. So I was like, what? So I got to go down there, and we did a run-through in the empty auditorium, and it just seemed so huge. I didn't realize how big that place was, and there was a balcony, and it held like 5,000 people. It's like it was a small city, and it was full. I think it was like 4,300 people that night, and it was so neat getting to do that. So that's kind of where it started. And then Louis said, here, I want you to stick around with a couple of these guys. And he had me tail guys for a couple of years, and that's kind of how it began.
Wow, that's amazing. I mean, that's amazing. And was this before or during you going through the issues with your mom?
This is way before.
Way before.
Yeah.
Way before.
Yeah, yeah, and she would say stuff like, I'd say, Ma, I got to go. And she'd say, where are you going? I got a show tonight. Well, who the hell would want to listen to you? Well, I don't know. I guess some. But she would do that to be a wise guy. You know, she wasn't doing it to be totally mean.
So what did she think of your comedy, though, when she, deep down inside?
She came to that auditorium at New Year's Eve, and she was there.
Uh-huh.
And Louie called out, and she got really crappy seats. I mean, they were in the balcony, like, way up high, like the second, up in the nosebleeds, like the second to last row. And Louie goes, Joe, is your mom here? Because she was coming to those little shows before. She goes, I'm way up here, and you could hear her all the way up there. He goes, boy, you got crappy seats. I know. But what she didn't like, because some of the early humor I did, I talked about having a big head. And it was like the Tanner family curse. We got big heads. And we got done, and, I asked her what she thought of it. And she said, well, she goes, I really don't appreciate the fat head stuff. She goes, your dad is so ashamed of that and very sensitive to it. She goes, no, you're up here talking about it. And I said, Ma, growing up with a fat head, you either learned how to fight or you learned how to joke about it. I wasn't a very good fighter. So.
Yeah.
And there's
well,
pretty much every fathead joke I've heard. So,
and you apparently weren't a liar either, because I guess the fathead thing is real.
It is.
That's too funny. That's too funny. Well, and so then listen, you have a caregiver personality, whether you know it or not, because the things that you did with your mom, the comedy thing, you may not see this big picture going back to 10 years old. And moving forward, but I really believe what I'm about to tell you is that all was a path, because I've seen what you've done with your comedy. You're doing benefits. Do I remember that you're also a preacher or a minister? You do weddings?
I do weddings. Well, and how I got the idea? Have you seen The Simpsons? Homer, Bart.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Well, there was a need in Springfield, where they lived. I think it's Springfield. There was no one to marry the gay couples. So Homer went online, and he paid $2 and got a certificate that said, Homer Simpson, he's a reverend. Okay, now I thought, I wonder if you can really get that. And so I went online, and there was a church called the Universal Life Church. And I think their motto is, don't be a dick to each other. Okay, it's pretty simple. And it didn't cost anything, and sure enough, I got this certificate that came out. It said Reverend Joseph Tanner, and, it was like, ha-ha, funny. I got to bring it to school or to work, and yuck, and pretty much everybody liked it. There was a Catholic guy that he thought I was just a horrible person for doing it. But I wasn't trying to mock anything. I was just trying to see if I could get it.
Just have fun.
And one of the nieces called up and said, Uncle Joe, can you marry us? And I said, no, this is not real. And she said, well, we're having a problem with the church or some issue, and I don't know what it was, because they were Catholic, and I really don't know what the problem was. But I said, I can't do it, but I went down to the courthouse. She said, would you try? So I went down there and told the lady how I got the certificate, just how I told you. And I said, this isn't going to work. She goes, if you got $15, it's going to work.
Yeah.
So I gave her $15, and she stamped it, and I've done 99 weddings so far.
Oh, my word. But Joe, you have an incredible, I mean, how do you just fall into 99 weddings? How do you fall into raising $100,000+ for, you know, however many families it was? How do you just fall? Yeah, I mean, these are incredible stories.
The first one that I did for the niece, okay, I'm not a minister or a pastor or anything, and I tell people that when they call, say, can you marry us? Yeah, but I'm just an officiant, we'll call it. And just so you know, and if you want something, I'll say the Lord's Prayer. We're not going any further than that. And then, anyway, we're sitting down there with the guy's mom and dad, and the dad's sitting right by me. He goes, so, Pastor, how long have you been preaching? And it's like, what? He goes, your ministry, where do you preach from? Where's your church? And I said, did they tell you what the deal is here? And he said, what do you mean, the deal? He goes, are you a minister or not? And I said, do you want the truth or do you want bullshit?
Yeah.
And he goes, I beg your pardon. I told him the story, and he got up, he was stormed off, and I went up to the kids, and I said, did you tell your dad that I'm a minister? Well, we kind of implied it. Well, he wants to beat me up right now. So, anyway, so that I've made sure ever since then they know up front. But there was one gal, because we've done a whole bunch of unique weddings, and she called up, and she, you know, and I went and met with a couple, and they lived on a farm, and they were in their 40s, I would bet, and they lived on a farm, and she said, we're going to have, like, the girls are going to be dressed like Ellie Mae Clampett, and the guys are going to wear bib overhauls, and it was going to be like that type of theme, and the kicker, she was going to be walked down the aisle by her pet cow. Okay. So it's like, okay, we'll do it. And, well, anyway, she called back. Everything was all set up, and we agreed on the price and everything. She calls back up, and she was just very upset. She goes, I have to tell you, we can't use you as our officiant. And I said, why? She goes, my mom doesn't want you to do it because you're not a minister. And I thought, she's okay with you getting walked down the aisle by a cow.
Right.
But I can't perform the ceremony, so.
I mean, I guess you didn't have a fat enough head or something. I mean, that is funny that the cow walking down the aisle is okay, but I guess they found a minister that would think that's okay.
There was one I did. It was on a golf course, and the girl wanted the perfect wedding. You know, like most of the couples, they want everything to go right. And I tell them, something's going to happen. Somebody's going to fall. A grandpa's going to fall out of the seat or something. Baby's going to cry. Nothing can happen. Well, okay, keep your fingers crossed. It was out on a golf course, and it was very beautiful. It was just a great setup, and nothing can go wrong, right? Well, we were about halfway through it, and three cows out of the farmer's field next to the golf course just came walking right over the fence, right through the wedding, just like they were invited. And it was like, this is the coolest thing ever.
Yeah. It's amazing when you put yourself out there as you do. It's amazing what humanity gives back to us.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and when you're genuine about it, I mean,
right.
I get upset sometimes with some of the things I see happening online, but then I hear stories like this, and I think that the internet was just, I mean, it's, if not for the internet, you couldn't have the reach that you have. And I mean, being as genuine as you are, you definitely are changing people's lives.
Yeah. Well, one thing we're doing now, I don't know if it's changing lives for better. We do every night at 7:00 Central Time. We do something called Joey Oki, and it's what do you get? I bill myself as a world famous comic. What do you get when you take a world famous comedian and you mix it with some bad karaoke, and you get Joey Oki, and it's about an hour long, and people come. We get you know, I don't know how. A lot of people watching it, and they'll make comments and stuff like that. I am not a good singer at all. and I'm the first one to admit it. And it's like, folks, please don't write in your comments, you suck, or anything like that, because I know I do. I don't need to be told we're here for fun. We're here to try and forget what's going on outside of us for an hour. And then what I will do with those, that video, when I'm done with that, I upload it to all these different Dementia Alzheimer sites, and it's starting to hit 2,000-3,000 views on those. People, they want to forget what's going on.
Yeah.
You know? And especially the ones who cannot go in to see mom or dad or husband or wife because they can't, they're not allowed in the care centers up here because of the virus.
Yeah.
So this gives those people about an hour to say, let's go sit and watch Joe make a boob of himself. And my wife does okay, and my daughter is a very, very good singer. And so she's kind of the show. My wife's like the feature act, and I'm the boob who opens. And somebody last night messaged me after it, and she said, I had to stop the show because she was showing like a watch party or a live feed. And she goes, somebody wrote something really bad in the comment section. She goes, I had to delete it, so I stopped it. She goes, I'm so sorry. And I said, what was it that's so bad? And she goes, I can't tell you. Well, was it about me? Was it about my head? I said, I've heard, you know, I can take stuff. I've been heckled by a lot, you know.
Yeah.
And she goes, I can't tell you. And she finally told me, she said, they wrote, when I started singing, they wrote, yikes. Did that supposed to hurt me? And how?
That's like a compliment.
Said, yeah, and I said, as a matter of fact, Cheryl, I said, the title of the episode, that was episode 19 last night, the episode was, we're at episode 19, yikes. So I said, maybe she saw it from there. But I said, my singing is worthy of a yikes. But then she said, well, she didn't write LOL after it. That's okay.
Yeah. And that is on your Facebook page, right?
Yeah, that's on my first one. It's just Joe Tanner.
Yeah. Joe Tanner comedian, yeah. Well, it doesn't say Joe Tanner comedian, but it calls you a comedian.
You know, well, you know what? Facebook doesn't allow you to put funky names on there anymore.
No, like, I know.
There was a wrestler friend of mine. He wrestles pro, or he did, Jumpin' Jim Brunzel. He was in the AWA, and then he was in the World Wrestling Federation. He can't use the name Jumpin' Jim Brunzel because it's wrong. It's not his real name or something.
Right, right.
So
they can find that on Joe Tanner. What was, again, tell us, because I think we had some interference when you said it the first time. Tell us the Facebook page that you started for your mom.
You'll Always Be My Mama.
You'll Always Be My Mama. I just struggled. Not struggled. That's not the word I was looking for. That was a Freudian slip. But I just scrolled through, and it was just really therapeutic to go back in time and see all of that, and it renewed my faith in the internet because, as I said, there's parts of the internet that I just get so frustrated about. But let's he's going to be mad at me when I say this.
Uh-oh.
But you got a level ahead of me. You got the Louis Anderson. I've done a lot of work with a guy by the name of Ryan Sickler. And Ryan has a podcast that's very successful. It's called The Honeydew. And he brings on comedians and non-comedians, but mostly comedians. And they talk about, the honeydew is what's always left over on the plate. That, you know, people know, you know, it's like throwaway. And his point is that he felt like a throwaway growing up with a rough childhood and all that sort of thing. And you talked about self-confidence as a child. I had issues with that, didn't feel comfortable in school, what have you. And I just think that, you know, all of these things forge us and make us who we are today. And I'm really, really just, I feel so good about how all of your things have come together to help other people. I do these, you might be a caregiver if statements, and I was wondering if you would want to come up with one for yourself.
For a statement? You mean?
Yeah, like you might be a caregiver if, and then, you know, a story about, you know, how you express yourself or, I can give you, an example for you. Yeah, or you can give me one for you.
Well, I would think, thinking of maybe myself and a lot of others out there, you might think you're a caregiver if you don't think you're doing enough. And in our case, for our mom was wonderful at playing the guilt game. And yet you would go, she had a visitor every day. One of us was always there, if not four or five of us. And she would still say, you don't come here hardly at all. And the staff would come up and tell her, Millie, we've never seen so many people visit a resident before. And you have to play that game of, am I doing enough? And my oldest sister was there twice a day. And she felt she's not doing enough. She was there to help feed her breakfast and lunch, and then the rest was to come at night. And if it's possible to get those thoughts out of your head, and I know it's not, but you have to remember about yourself as well. And you have to say, you know what? And it gets tough. You sometimes have to say, you know what? I need to take a break. And in our case, where we had six or seven people, you could say, I'm not going up there for a couple of days.
Right.
So I think if you find yourself having those thoughts, you truly are a caregiver. And in our case, Mom was home for a couple years. And, you know, then the last couple, she was in the memory center. And at home, you know, I would talk to her every day on the phone. As a mailman, you could have your earbuds in and talk. And I remember telling the others, I would say, I think, Mom, something's going on. Because, like, I use an example. I could say, I talked to Lon today on a show, and then 5 minutes later, she go, well, what's new? I just told you. You didn't say anything.
Yeah.
You had those things going on. So I kind of saw this coming on, and I just thought I have to keep talking to Mom every day. And so that was my thing, or else I'm going to feel wrong or like I'm not doing what I can. But like I said, you have to take time for yourself, too.
Yeah. Well, you want to talk about making some, I feel guilty now. I can't think of I'm saying this halfway as a joke, but also as a point to myself, is that I'm not talking to my mom enough. You know, I hear from people all the time as we're going through this virus that they can't see their loved ones, they can't visit, and, you know, my mom actually is in a retirement community right now, and I can't go visit her, but I've been guilty in great stretches to say, well, I can't go visit her, and that's it. You know, I can talk to her. Now, it's funny. My mom doesn't tolerate that very long. She's like, all right, I got things I want to do. She wants to get me off the phone as quick as we get on it.
We could talk for hours. One thing toward the end, though, that was tough, like she knew I was delivering my mail. And part of my route was a business route. And in the morning, you know, you're doing the businesses, and you might go into the ABC company, say, here's your mail. You got any outgoing? And I would say, Mom, I'm going into a business right now. Hang on. And I'd say, hi, Judy. Here's your mail. You know, you got any outgoing? And Mom goes, who the hell is Judy? What are you calling me Judy for? She was starting to lose it a little bit where she didn't get what I just told her.
Right.
But she, one time, and this wasn't really funny, but I think it's funny, but she goes, and we lost our dad in 1981. So we lost him. He was only 60. So he's been gone all these years. And Mom and Dad only had one car. They've only had one car. And he worked days and she would work evenings. And how was it? She said, I need to talk to you about your dad. This is just a couple years ago. And I said, what about him? She goes, I need to know where he is. And I thought, do I tell her that he died?
Yeah.
And what do you do in this? Because we didn't even really tell her she had dementia. And whether that's right or wrong, that's how it happened. And she goes, I want to know where your dad is. And I said, well, Ma, I got something to tell you. I said, Dad died in 1981. It was like 30-some years ago. And she goes, that SOB. She goes, that explains where the hell he's been. She goes, I needed the car to get to work. She didn't just say SOB. She said the whole thing.
Yeah. Well, you know, hearing you tell that story, you know, you said, I don't know if that was right or wrong. I don't think there is any right or wrong. There's just how it happens and you know, and what you do about it from then. I've talked to some people in the, you know, industry right now that are going through the virus challenges, and I said, hey, you have to love your decisions, because they're made with the best of intentions and the best of, you know, information at the time. And I'm sure you consulting others, like in your case, a big family. I mean, you have to love your decisions, because there can quickly come a day, maybe the very next day, where you no longer like your decisions. And that's hindsight. That becomes an analytical thing. But when you're making them, it's, you try and be analytical, but there's a lot of emotional in it. So there's no right or wrong. Love what you do because you're doing it for the right reasons, even if later you don't like it.
One of the decisions I made one day, everybody had all these great ideas because Mom would always say, you're lying, you're not coming up here. We made the calendar like, you know, so many families do. Joe was here Monday, Lon was here Tuesday, Patty was here. And Mom said, I know you're lying. She goes, you're just writing all the names in there. She goes, none of you are coming up here. She goes, none of you want to be out. She goes, I raised eight of you, and now eight of you can't even come to visit. And I blew up at her. It was like, Jesus Christ, we're up here. Don't you quit calling my brothers and sisters liars. I was pissed, and I was yelling at her. And I'm not going to win this battle, and I felt bad about doing it. And I got home, and I told my wife, I don't remember if I cried or not. I was just so ticked off. It's like, she doesn't believe us, and we're up there every day, and blah, blah, blah. And I wasn't home 10 minutes. My mom called, Joe, are you coming up here today?
Yeah.
So it's like I got a free yelling in, and she forgot about it.
Yeah.
So it was kind of a good note. But, you know, you talk about... Oh, go ahead.
No, please, you.
Well, I was going to say just some of the things growing up, and I'm glad the world has changed how it has. We had the eight kids, and, you know, we had free lunches and things like that and welfare and things. And I remember going to school, and especially in senior high, you're trying to be cool or whatever you're trying to be, trying to find your group, your place. The first of the month, you had to line up in the main commons, the main area, and there was a big sign that said free and reduced lunch tickets. And you had to stand in that stupid-ass line, and all your friends are walking around seeing you, and you don't want to say, my dad has a bad job. And dad always worked. He just didn't have good jobs. And you had to stand in this line, and you were embarrassed, or I was embarrassed to be there. I was grateful I had lunch, don't get me wrong, but I didn't want to be in that line. And so I would be sick that first day of the month. And the second day, I would show up, and there would only be like five or six kids in line, and you'd get your tickets, and boom, you're out of there. And the lunch lady, she knew my folks. She knew the situation. She goes, you know what, Tanner? She goes, it's people like you that have me waste the second day sitting here. She goes, you pull this crap every month. And I thought, I mean, you're a kid. You're not going to mouth off to an authority figure in school. And I just thought, good God, you know. And I was so glad years later, the kids who get the free lunches now, you go up, everybody punches in a four-digit code or whatever. Nobody knows who has free lunch. Nobody knows if your mom and dad put $100 in your account. Nothing. I'm just so glad some of the things have changed.
Yeah. Boy, it's incredible how searing those memories are.
Yeah. Well, we always wanted Levi jeans. And we couldn't afford them. And I remember I went out for
a drama. You can't afford them now.
You can't afford them now, yeah. I guess this one hasn't ever fixed. But so I wanted a pair of Levi's, and I went out for a play in the drama club. And I got it. My character was whatever it was. I don't even remember. But he wore a pair of Levi pants. And when it came time to turn the costumes back in, I kept those pants. That's how I got my Levi's. And it's right at the drama department.
Is your first paid gig.
Yeah, I got paid a pair of pants.
That's amazing. Oh, that's funny. That is funny. Well, I tell you, I worship, in retrospect, every one of my hardships growing up as a child, because I really think they've made me a more humble, better person than I otherwise would have been, because, you know, as I put some distance between my childhood and my adulthood and gained my own confidence and found my own path, you know, I can get rolling and start feeling pretty good about myself, and then I get those, you know, reminders. It's not like I get flashbacks or anything, but that humble beginnings, you know, what did Nietzsche say? That which that if it doesn't kill us, it makes us stronger. And I'm not ending this, but I want to recommend to you Chris D'Elia's Netflix special. I really like Chris D'Elia because he's got a different type of comedy. But he talks about comedians always had really bad childhoods. That's what makes them funny. And he goes, "Nah, I had a great childhood." and then he goes on and gets mad at his parents for his great childhood. So it's just, I think you'd enjoy it if you haven't seen it already.
But no, that's a neat twist. I'll look for that. One thing, because like I said, with school, you know, the free lunches and everything, and you don't know where you're at in the poll. You just know you're kind of a bottom feeder is how I felt. And we had our 40th reunion here 2 years ago for high school. And I went there, and I remembered most of the kids. You know, they're, of course, they change a little bit. And I'm lucky I got a full head of hair.
You know who you're talking to, right?
Yeah, some of these guys do not. And I mean, that's funny, but whatever. But I remember seeing this one and this one and this one. And the one girl came up, because I'm writing a book, too. I forgot, did I tell you that?
No, but make sure you tell the audience.
All right. So anyway, I'm at this class reunion. I was just going from one to the other. Remember me, blah, 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 and you're talking. And this girl came up. She goes, I got to talk to you about something. She goes, I remember you from school. And she goes, you were this shy boy that sat in the corner. You didn't hardly talk to anybody. And she goes, now you're the most popular kid here. What happened?
Yeah.
And I didn't realize it. It's like, and I'm not going to say it about myself, but it's like, well, I guess I kind of was flying around like a little bumblebee here tonight. So that was kind of good.
Yeah. Well, you grew up. I mean, you flourished.
Yeah. Well, and one thing
I was just going to say, a lot of the guys that I was, you know, intimidated by in middle school and high school, you know, I'm not going to name their names, but they all shrunk in so many ways, I'd rather be a late bloomer than a real confident young kid any day.
Right. There was, you know, I mentioned I worked as a bouncer in the bars. There was a couple guys that would bully me and give me crap, and back then, I don't think it was even bullied, was talked about. It was just like, that kid's just an ass, right?
Right.
And so here I am. You know, when I graduated, I was like 152, and all of a sudden I'm this 225-pound guy working in a bar, and I'm not going to say the name of the two guys either, but one guy comes in, and he gave me so much crap during 7th and 8th grade, and the guy wasn't doing anything wrong in the bar, but I knew who he was, and he stayed kind of smaller.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, there he wasn't doing anything wrong. And I walked up to him. I just grabbed him by the hair in the back of the pants. I said, you're outside. And he wanted to go. He's like, what did I do to you? And I thought, do I tell him who I am or do I just beat him up? So I beat him up. But so that was kind of cheap.
Yeah.
But it was just, some of those memories you don't forget.
Yeah. Yeah.
But,
well, they forge us. I mean, there's no doubt our experiences do forge us. But they forged you into a very passionate man that has some humor in how he walks through life. And, you reached out and touched thousands of people after taking care of your mom. You've raised money for, it sounds like you're just figuring out how to have fun with life. And I'm very proud of that and envious.
One thing I regret is when Dad was, I don't know, he must, because he died at 60, he must have been 57, 58, and he was diabetic, and he needed to go down to the Veterans Hospital, which is down in Minneapolis, and because of the laser beam treatments or laser treatments they did on his eyes, he was bleeding in his eyes, it would make it so he couldn't see very well, so he would have to take the bus, and he asked me one time if I would go with him, and I said no. Because I didn't. Hang on a second.
Sure.
I didn't want to be seen with a blind man. Because I would have to help him. And I just.
Yeah.
Told myself years later, I will never not help anybody again.
Man, you're getting, we're about to have dead air because you're getting me now. I need a minute. I hope you've forgiven yourself, and you certainly have. If that was part of your motivation to change the way you reach out to others, then that was I'm speechless at the raw emotion of that, and that's the beauty of Joe Tanner is that...
The one guy, I ended up worked in a bowling alley part-time, and there was a guy there named Dick Darges, and Dick ended up dying of cancer. But he said, can you... Because most of my nights, you know, I work nights. He said, can you take me down for my radiation? Of course I can. And I really liked Dick. He was like a second dad. And we would get down there, and he had, I think it was bone cancer or something, but he said, tell me something funny. And I would tell him a joke, and he'd start laughing. and then you'd cry because it hurt.
Ooh.
And, you know, you felt bad. It's like, well, then he'd say, tell me something funny. No, Dick, you're going to cry. And no, tell me. And he said, I'd rather laugh for a couple minutes than just cry without the laughter. So that made me feel good in a way. You know, you don't want to make another man cry, but he wanted humor.
Yeah.
And I guess it seems like I have a knack of telling some stories.
Yeah. Well, I think he wanted that personal connection as well. And that's amazing. So, Joe, if you could get in the hot tub time machine, and other than going with your dad to that appointment, what would you change? What advice would you give your young self or your before you realized that you were a caregiver for your mom, or before you went on any of this journey where you're sharing yourself with others for their benefit, what advice would you give yourself?
Well, I would have said, go on to school. I wish I would, because I made it through high school, and that was it. And I remember at my open house, one of my uncles said, well, what are you going to do now? It's like, well, we're going to go play wiffle ball in the backyard. What do you mean, what am I going to do now? I'm done. I would have said, go on to some schooling. And not that the mailman, I mean, that was a great job, but you're like a glorified paper boy sometimes, you felt.
Yeah.
But it was a very good job, and it gave me a lot of chances. So I would say continue with the education. You know, I think I treated people okay, so I don't think I have to say I wish I wasn't such a jerk. I think one thing I would tell my young self is when you go in this one bar in Fridley, Minnesota, watch out for the guy with the pool stick. He got me good.
Well, Joe, I've enjoyed this time together. I'm very happy that I found you. I'm very happy that you're sharing. You know, you'll always be my mama with the world. It's still out there for them to enjoy. And I'm very happy that Joe Tanner's doing Joey karaoke or Joey-okey.
Joey-okey
at, what, 7, when is it?
7 o'clock Central. It's every night until the lockdown here in Minnesota is lifted.
Oh, my gosh. That is a heck of a campaign. Well, I better let you get prepped for that and rest up that machine of yours.
My beautiful pipes, yeah. and then the book, I'll get a hold of you one day. I got a book coming out. It's called Letters from the Mailman.
Oh, I love it. Well,
that's coming.
I got some suggestions for you when you get ready to publish that. I'll be glad to help you.
Okay.
Joe Tanner, this has been a great hour or so that we spent together. I can't thank you enough for this. And Joe Tanner, you might be a caregiver. Thank you for caring.
Thank you.
Okay, so by way of confession, well, there you go, folks, another episode of the podcast, and this one was fun. Joe and I had so many directions we wanted to go in that we were a little, misdirectional in the beginning. We wanted to go into so many directions that we went in no direction initially, but we found our stride, and I found it very enjoyable. And one of the reasons I was distracted as I was taping the intro to the podcast is because I am watching the 21st episode of Joey Oki on Facebook right now. It's streaming live. It's on You'll Always Be My Mama on Facebook, and the link will be on my website in the for this episode. But we had a great conversation, probably even a better conversation after we stopped recording, because we knew each other at that point and there was no pressure, but just an interesting guy, and I had a lot of fun, and I hope you did too. And you know, I am learning so much from these podcasts, and selfishly, it almost doesn't even matter that anything else is going on. I know that I feel very honored once a week to have an intimate conversation, both recorded and before and after the recording, with someone of similar interest and similar personality and similar focus in the world. And I feel better for it. I feel like a better man and a better caregiver, and one day maybe a better podcaster. We all have unique caregiver stories, and I hope you're enjoying hearing some of them here on the podcast. If you want to share your story, you can contact me at thecaregiverspodcast@gmail.com or just find us on Facebook. We're out there. We're not hiding from you, folks. But thanks again for listening. Please leave us a 5-star review. Let me know what you think, even if you think I talk too much. But I think I'm getting a little better about that. You could tell me that. That would be okay. Praise. I'm getting better at taking praise. But most importantly, please share this with others that you think might benefit from these caregiver stories and the Caregivers Podcast itself. But just take care of yourself out there. It's scary times. Wash your hands. Get some sleep. Drink some red wine and eat some chocolate and get up the next day and do it again. So go out there, do what you do, be good, and honor yourself as you care for others, because you might be a caregiver. Thank you for caring. Bye-bye now.